history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are untold stories there, stories that should not remain untold, but will unless we take the initiative to ask a few questions and take the time to patiently listen. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And you know, it's amazing what happens when we do that. All the things that we gain in the process. We're educated, we're entertained. Often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It is Memorial Day weekend, and it definitely feels a little different this year. In some parts of our country, even the ability to place flags in cemeteries to honor the fallen is limited because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But honor them we will. Today you're going to hear the memories of two World War II veterans, one in the Pacific, one in Europe, and what they were experiencing 75 years ago this week. And if you're thinking, wait a second, I thought the war in Europe was already over 75 years ago this week, you're right, but it wasn't over yet for this particular veteran. If you go all the way back to the War for Independence, well over a million Americans have died while serving our country. And Memorial Day is our opportunity to remember them and their supreme sacrifice. More than 406,000 Americans paid that ultimate price during World War II. One of those was a Marine fighter pilot named Maynard Kelly. He was posthumously awarded the Navy Cross, but it had nothing to do with his exploits in the air. Keep that name in mind as we hear the story of another veteran whose path would intersect with Kelly's exactly 75 years ago this Memorial Day on Okinawa. Dana Mulder, nicknamed Zeke, was in his first year at Loma Linda University in Southern California when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. He was living with his aunt near that Seventh-day Adventist school and majoring in theology.
I came home and she said, well, there were a couple men here today. And she said, they were FBI and they're asking about you. And I thought, well, what did I do wrong? Come to find out, the Adventists were asked to be non-combatants. In other words, they feel, thou shalt not kill. And so they, but they had anticipated this. So then in my senior year, they had it was like a school where you go to it and learn to march and how to do first aid and a whole bunch of anything that had to do with, you know, where you could participate in war, but you weren't supposed to work on Sabbath or to kill.
Sure.
And so anyway, I participated in that all that year. See, when I started taking theology, then I guess they were just checking up on everybody. But anyway, that was where that's how I ended up there.
I guess that would get your attention when you come home and find out the FBI was on your tail.
Well, yeah, and she said they'd been following me, so I don't know. But it kind of surprised me. But you want to remember that in the story because it had a consequence. In other words, everything I'm telling you seemed to lean one way or another and affect my life in one way or another. I went and took, you know, a physical. I didn't pass the eye test. Because I wore glasses all my life, and it's just I had poor eyesight. The only thing is, the only salvation was I was so farsighted, so I could see in the distance actually better than I could with a book. And so reading was always kind of difficult to me because I couldn't see too well. There was a lady in Hollywood that said for a certain amount of money she could make it so I could pass the eye test. So I said, okay, let's go for it.
And now, I think you told me $350?
Yeah.
Now, that's a lot of money in the 1940s.
I thought, well, if that's what it takes. But I went to her for about four times, I think. And in other words, she charged me so much each time, but the total thing was $300 and some. Anyway, I went and took the test again, and I passed it. So then I thought, okay, well, I'm in. So I went to the induction center. I joined the Navy then. I went to the induction center. They passed me there. And I for those that went through the induction, it was quite a, it was kind of almost comical sometimes. Some of the questions they'd ask you, they would, do you like girls, and do you do this or you do that, and I don't know whether they'd get in trouble for asking questions like that now or not, but anyway, that's the way it was there. But anyway, they accepted me, and so then I had 10 days, I think it was, and then I went in, I went to San Diego to be inducted. So in San Diego, when I arrived there, they gave us another physical. The guy that he gave me the physical, he said, well, how did you get in here? You can't see. And I said, well, I'm here. Why don't you just let me stay? And he thought for a while and says, okay. So here I am in the Navy.
When you did get in the Navy, they asked you, well, what are you good at? What kind of experience have you had? And what did you tell them?
Well, I told them about when I had taken that first aid training, and, you know, I just shared that with them. And so the doctor said, well, it sounds like you've had enough first aid experience and enough marching experience and all that. And because of my eyesight, he said, well, I'm going to put you in the hospital corps, the Navy Medical Corps. I was a corpsman then in the Navy. I didn't even go to corps school, which was everybody that went into Navy were supposed to do that. So here I went immediately out of boot camp. Why, then I was at the San Diego Hospital, and that was the Naval Hospital there in San Diego. It's just next to Balboa Park.
So were you seeing patients there that were soldiers already back from the war?
I was like an aide, or, you know, I wasn't a doctor. I was just...
Right, sure.
I was just working on the ward. Tarawa had been a big battle in the Pacific, and I was on a ward where you have bone problems. You know, we had the guys that had been in that action on Tarawa. We had them. So that's where I was working.
Was that hard for you to see how these guys had been disfigured and wounded and injured? What did that do to you just as a young man? I mean, you're still a teenager, and having to stare that stuff square in the face every day.
I never did look at it that way. I always just felt like, well, I'm helping these guys, and you felt sorry for them, and yet I was surprised at the attitude that some of those guys that were wounded and had broken bones and this type of thing, the ones that were recuperating, if they were well enough, they would give them some type of small assignments of jobs to do. And we had an elevator that went up and down in the hospital. The guy that ran the elevator had lost a leg.
Mm.
And so he had a wooden leg. And one day I went up the elevator, and he had his leg off, and he was hollowing out a hole inside it where your calf would be. He says, oh, this is where I can hide stuff, you know. And he didn't feel, I was so surprised that he would take the attitude like, well, poor me. He was just like, I'm glad to be alive. I'm glad to be here. And I'm just having a good time.
And I imagine the more people you see like that, the harder it is to ever feel sorry for yourself.
Well, that's true. That's true. When I first went to Naval Hospital, a friend of mine that I had met in college, he came to me and he said, hey, they're sending a bunch of cycle patients back to Fort Worth, Texas, and it's going to take a couple weeks. Why don't you sign up for it? I said, well, that sounds like a good deal. So I signed up for it. But then when I got back to San Diego from that trip on the train, then they put me on night duty. And the night duty was one full month every night of the week, every day it was. It was just you were continuous on that time. Well, my problem was that my folks lived in San Diego then in El Cajon. I'd work nights, and in the daytime you don't sleep all day long, so I'd get up and go home and visit my folks, or sometimes I'd even go as far away as L.A. and visit some friends up there, and then I'd be back. Well, about towards the end of that month of night duty, one night the nurse came to me and she said, you're just worn out. And she led me back to the solarium and to the bed back there and put me in the sack. And she says, I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. Anyway, then when I got off of night duty, they were having spinal meningitis. There was a case in that. In fact, one person had died, and there were two more that were sick. So here they put me on that ward, and I thought, good night. I can remember walking down the street there at the hospital, and I thought, here I get in here. I've got things going my way, and there they put me on a ward, and I'm going to get spinal meningitis and die right here. And so I went to a yeoman who took care of the personnel, and I told her, I said, I don't want to be there. I want to get out of there. And she says, well, I'll see what I can do. Well, the next day, I went back to see her again, and she looked kind of surprised, and she said, well, I haven't had time to do anything. And I said, well, I want you to do something. She said, you don't tell me what to do. She says, I'm going to fix you. And I said, I won't give you a chance. I said, I want sea duty. And she says, I don't have any sea duty. So I said, well, give me the Fleet Marines. Now, that was, if I'd have known what the Fleet Marines were like, and the casualty figures of what those guys went through, why I wouldn't have been so eager. But anyway, that was on a Tuesday. And Thursday morning, before about 6 o'clock, they got us up out of the sack. We went out and stood in front of the barracks, and they had what they called short arms inspection. After we passed that, then they sent us to, they called it Field Med School.
Right.
Where the Navy guys made the transfer into the Marine Corps. And that was an 8-week course, so that's how I ended up at the Marine Corps.
And how long would it be from there till you ended up shipping overseas?
Well, then it was over a year, about maybe a year and 2 or 3 months. Of course, I went through the Field Med School, and then I was assigned to an aviation outfit at Miramar. That in itself was a blessing right there. The good Lord looks after fools and little children, and sometimes I did things foolishly. But anyway, that year that I spent at El Toro, it was a good learning experience because, you know, we were busy. We had a lot of stuff going on, and that time passed very rapidly.
And after that time, you finally were sent overseas. You were assigned to a squadron of Marine pilots?
Yes. We were F-4Us, and at that time, the F-4U was about the most deadly plane in the Pacific. Now, the Zeros were more maneuverable, but the pilots of the F-4Us finally got on how to handle them, and so our squadron, that was 39 kills, and that was only in the period of about, not more than 2 months, 3 months. We were assigned to the north end of Okinawa, and the F-4Us were doing like picket duty, and they were up further north kind of trying to protect the picket ships. And those are the people that took quite a bit of casualties. The Japanese would get in there real quick. But anyway, that's how many planes we got. But that was a year and a half, about not quite a year and a half after when I got to Okinawa.
And that's what we're going to talk about when we come back. Something happened on Okinawa on the night of May 24th on into the early morning hours of May 25th, 1945, that did not happen at any other point in that 83-day battle that claimed over 14,000 American lives. The Japanese called it a Giretsu attack. Find out what that means when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this Memorial Day weekend as we honor every man and woman who has ever been killed in the service of our country. For our Gold Star families, every day is Memorial Day, and that's often the case for those whose role in war is to try to save the lives of those who were wounded in action. My grandfather was a decorated doctor in World War II, but the Silver Star and Bronze Star he received were never what consumed his thoughts and dreams and flashbacks. Instead, it was the memory of those men he wished he could have saved. If you've seen the award-winning film Hacksaw Ridge, you have that line from Medal of Honor recipient Desmond Doss, who famously saved 75 men on Okinawa in April of 1945. "Lord, please help me get one more," he prayed repeatedly during the course of his heroics. Like Doss, Zeke Mulder had been raised in the Seventh-day Adventist faith. Like Doss, that's what steered him toward the medical side of combat. Mulder would be decorated for his efforts 75 years ago this weekend, trying to save a hero who ultimately could not be saved. But as we're going to hear, something else he did contributed to 10 lives being saved. Before we hear that story of the Japanese Giretsu attack on Okinawa's Yantan Airfield on May 24, 1945, let's hear about Zeke's arrival on the island on the first day of combat there.
It turned out so different than what they anticipated. They thought that Okinawa would be a bloodbath, and it was, but it didn't happen on the beaches. I woke up on April 1st, it was April Fool. Here we were already up against the shore. The LST had dropped the door, the ramp that drove up into the ship itself. They started unloading, and the first vehicle off was a what they called a 10-wheeler. They drove off. The front of the truck dropped in a big hole, and the guys that were driving the truck, there were two of them. One was driving, the other riding. They were sitting in water up to their waist. That's how. Then in other words, the truck was just heading down into the water. So we had to pull up the ramp. They drug that truck out. And then we had to move. So we were kind of sitting targets at that time, too. But there was no opposition at all. I stayed on the ship till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They wanted me on the ship, so they had a corpsman on the ship. The other guys had gone ashore already. So at 3 o'clock, they let me loose. So I rode a duck. I called it the duck. But anyway, there were two guys driving the duck hauling material and whatever ashore, and so they said, "Well, get in," and I just got in, and when we got ashore, they were going to go down the beach, and I was going to go right up the hill to the airport, so they let me off, and then I started walking, and I was the only one there on the beach.
What were you thinking? I imagine there's a lot of different things that could be going through your mind. What do you think was going through your mind?
I really didn't anticipate what would happen, and I, for some reason or another, I wasn't worried. And I look back on it now, I thought, well, my goodness, I'd be fretting and everything else. Here I'm all by myself, and but I didn't, you know, maybe I don't worry enough. But
if you were a corpsman there at Okinawa, you could have been assigned to handling Marine Corps casualties on the ground, some of the infantry units, of course, Army units were there as well. But you were on a crash crew. Tell me what that meant.
The planes take off in groups of two or three at a time. If something goes wrong, then to save the pilot or, you know, to take care of the situation, you have a fire crew, you have an ambulance on the line, and so that was your duty, was to sit there and watch the airplanes land and take off. And basically, our main concern was if planes have been shot up, and when they come in and they crash, then you want to save the pilot.
Sure.
And so I was the ambulance driver. The CO or the doctor that was in charge of us, he said, "I don't care how fast you go," but he said, "I want you to be the first vehicle next to that airplane when something happens. You can't really do anything for about 10 minutes till things cool down," but he said it induces the morale of all the people that see this going on. They say, well, help is going to be there if I have problems. Well, that was my duty. we were fortunate. We really didn't. We lost a couple pilots in the landing pattern. In other words, they would stall out, and we lost a couple pilots that way. But we really didn't have that many crashes on the runway itself. We had a privateer, which was a Navy bomber. They couldn't get the wheels down, and so when we got down at the end of the runway, and when we were behind the airplane, and so they landed with wheels up, and the belly of the airplane was, it had a high wing on it, a four-engine, but it had a high wing.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys that were inside of it, they hung on to there were things that they grab on the top of the airplane or on the inside of the airplane, and they all lifted up their feet. The only problem was that when they hit the coral, and the coral was shooting up, and so they had, they were kind of like they'd been peppered with buckshot on their butt.
And you got to tend to them?
Yeah, we just, a little mercuricum and iodine here and there and whatever. Anyway, that's what the crash chute did. And I got the man out of the tower, but I actually saved at least 10 guys' lives, because during that action that night.
Well, let's talk about this, because now what you're talking about is the incident that earned you the Bronze Star, and it did involve a man in the tower that you carried down. But I'll let you pick up the story from there. What you remember about that night, how did you save 10 men's lives, and then how did you carry a man down the stairs on your back? Because that doesn't sound easy either. So I'll let you take it from the top.
Okay, well, then I'll try to. The Japanese, they called it kyutsu or something. It was just a suicide group of planes that were going to land on the runway, and then they would jump out of the airplane and then start with satchel charges. They would tie them to as many airplanes that were on the ground as they could. That night, they got 19 airplanes.
Holy moly!
Before there were only one plane was successful in landing and discharging its, the guys that were in the Japanese.
Right.
But let's go to the guy in the tower. When they landed, crash landed. Why, he had a light, a real bright spotlight that he'd turn on to signal the airplanes that they could land or take off. It was a signal like light, but it was very bright and very, very intense. And so he shone that light on that airplane with these guys. See, it belly landed, so it skidded.
The Japanese airplane.
And he shone the light on them, and one of the Japanese shot at the light. And, of course, he didn't get the light, but the pilot, the tower operator for that night, it hit him right in just below your rib cage. And it missed his heart, and it was a wooden bullet. At least that's what they told me later, that it was a wooden bullet, because when it went through him, there was just a little hole where it went in. But where it came out, it was probably, as big as a grapefruit or something like that, just in his back. So here I get up there, and I was trying to help him because he was still conscious and he was okay. Well, he wasn't okay, but he was wounded. But I tried to kind of patch him up as quick as I could and give him morphine. And that was one thing that we were learning to do, is to try to take away the pain right away. But anyway, I gave him the shot, and then I got to checking him over, and I saw that there was no way that I could do anything really to help him there, because it was just too bad of a situation. I didn't have enough. So I thought, I've got to get him out of here. And just about then, one of the other corpsmen finally came up the ladder. Now, the tower was about 30 feet high. It was made out of wood, and it had a wooden ladder that went up.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, how can we get him down? And so I thought, well, the only way to get him down is to carry him down. And I didn't want to drop him. And if I got shot or something, I didn't want to drop him. And so we had a rope there that they would carry stuff up and down on, from the tower.
Right.
And I had them tie the rope around him, And then I got him on my, this other guy helped me get him on my shoulders, and then I just backed down the ladder and got him on the ground and immediately put him in the ambulance. I didn't know what the best way to get to the hospital would be, and so I thought, well, one of the runways wasn't being used, and the plane wasn't on that one, and so I went down the unused runway, down the hill, got him to the hospital, and there were corpsmen there immediately to pick him up and take him in, and that's the last I saw of him. But the sad part of the story and the thing that I've always regretted is that I couldn't save him. He died towards morning that day.
It was certainly not for lack of effort or ingenuity or persistence on your part, and clearly that is why they chose to give you the Bronze Star for your efforts that night. You also said that there were 10 lives that were saved in conjunction with the same incident. How did that happen?
Well, see, I got back to the tower. You know, that's where the crash crews, we stayed there right by the tower so we could get immediate, instruction from the... But anyway, that privateer that was loaded to go out into the China Sea the next morning was loaded with bombs, fuel, and the whole bit. And they put a satchel charge on that, and it started burning.
Oh,
well,
boy.
A lieutenant came running along there, and he told the cries on the crash crew, get down there and get that fire out. And then he ran on. I didn't have much authority, but the guys came to me, and they said, Doc, what should we do? Because we knew what was going to happen. It was burning, and we knew how much ammunition and all the stuff it had on it. So I said, well, don't go. You'll get killed. Don't go. So pretty soon here came the lieutenant again. What are you guys doing? You're supposed to be down there and get that fire out. So then he went on again, and they said, what should we do? And I said, well, don't go. And they said, well, we've got to. He told us we have to go. And I said, okay, drive as slow as you can. And they took off, and they probably went maybe, 200 or 300 feet or maybe a little more than that. And that thing blew. And I mean, it was the biggest explosion you ever saw. The next morning I went and looked, and the biggest parts were parts of the engines. And there was a hole in the ground that you could put a 10-wheel truck in. And if those guys had gone down there, they wouldn't have survived at all. And I felt better about that than the other part. But
wow, I don't blame you. And I'm sure they felt pretty good about it, too, in retrospect.
Well, we kind of looked, everybody looked out after everybody else, you know. There was really, I was pleased at the attitude of everyone. We tried to do the best we could, and we were all green, and we were all, most everybody was under 21.
It was a long, long time ago, and you talk about looking out for each other. I get the idea in listening to you share some of your stories that you felt pretty strongly that somebody was looking out for you.
Okay, when this happened, my folks were asleep at home in San Diego or El Cajon, and my dad woke up and he said, "I was just impressed that I should pray for you." And I didn't know that at the time, and when I got home and was telling some of the stories, when he told me that, I thought, "Oh my goodness," you know. I mean, I was so impressed. So I feel like all of this thing just fit together into a pattern of the good Lord was looking out after me, I guess. And like I say, I didn't do everything right, but at least he watched over me, and I came away without a scratch.
Zeke Mulder came away without a scratch, but you heard his disappointment that the man in the tower that he tried so hard to save could not be saved. I mentioned that Gold Star hero's name earlier, First Lieutenant Maynard C. Kelly. Now, here's the rest of the story. A native of Seattle, Maynard Carter Kelly had joined the Marine Corps in 1943, and he had already earned the Distinguished Flying Cross, piloting F-6F Hellcats with VMF 533, a night fighter squadron operating out of Yantan on the western coast of Okinawa. Just a week earlier, he was in pursuit of a Japanese plane when he was hit by anti-aircraft fire from one of the American American ships offshore. Kelly couldn't make it back to Yantan and had to make an emergency landing at nearby Aishima. On the night of May 24th, Maynard Kelly was taking his turn standing duty watch in the tower when that Japanese Garetsu raid unfolded. And the reason he was posthumously awarded the Navy Cross was what he did before Zeke Mulder came to his aid. This was the only time the Japanese made an airborne landing on Okinawa in the entire battle. As Zeke described, four of the five Japanese planes were shot down, but the one Sally bomber was able to make a belly landing on the runway. It skidded to a stop just about 250 feet from the tower. When Maynard Kelly saw that, he hopped in the radio jeep parked just in front of the tower and raced out toward the plane armed just with a service revolver. He was actually able to kill one of the enemy commandos before exploding planes chased him back to the tower. That's when he went up to the searchlight. As his Navy Cross citation states, determined to halt the hostile invasion, he fearlessly exposed himself to a merciless concentration of fire to train a spotlight on the enemy aircraft and troops, and skillfully directing the small arms fire of other Marines, continually harassed and ultimately frustrated all enemy attempts to reach and destroy our parked aircraft and vital field installations. Fatally wounded as he persevered in his courageous efforts, First Lieutenant Kelly, by his alert presence of mind, shrewd tactics, and indomitable fighting spirit in the face of tremendous odds, had served as an inspiration to his fighting comrades and contributed immeasurably to the repulse of this abortive Japanese attack, which resulted in the annihilation of approximately 71 of the enemy. His determined initiative and personal valor throughout sustained and enhanced the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. He gallantly gave his life for his country. I've encountered other accounts that suggest Kelly was killed by friendly fire, but you heard Zeke Mulder, who tended to his wound, state not only that it was Japanese fire, but that in this case the enemy was using wooden bullets, which had of course been outlawed by the Geneva Convention as inhumane. Kelly's body was returned to the States. You can visit his grave now at Golden Gate National Cemetery in San Bruno, California. Maynard Carter Kelly, one of the Gold Star heroes we honor this Memorial Day. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, a man whose family believed he had been killed in action. He was just tasting freedom again 75 years ago this week after an ordeal you have to hear to believe. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this Memorial Day weekend 2020. Just saying those words reminds me of Memorial Day weekend 10 years ago. In front of a Walmart in Mesa, Arizona, I met up with two ex-prisoners of war who had gone out in the desert heat to hand out poppies for remembrance, a Memorial Day tradition that goes all the way back to France during World War I. One of those veterans was Dale Shabilsky. 75 years ago this week, more than 2 weeks after VE Day, he was about to finally taste freedom again. Dale had joined the Army Air Corps as a 17-year-old in his native Nebraska, serving as a radio man and gunner aboard B-24 Liberators with the 456th Bomb Group flying out of Italy. He had already survived some pretty close calls before his 33rd and final mission.
We got a citation. We made the trip all the way back from Auschwitz and Poland to Italy on two engines without jettisoning anything. As a result of that, we got a recognition for not jettisoning and making the longest mission recorded on B-24 with two engines.
So you must have had a pretty hot shot pilot or some divine intervention or something, huh?
Some of both.
And I imagine when you did touch those wheels down, there's a pretty big sense of relief or maybe applause throughout the plane or what?
I was shooting flares out of the top of the plane so that the ground crew would be alerted to the fact that we didn't know if our wheels would collapse when we hit or not. But fortunately, everything gave us a smooth landing, and none of us were hurt.
Think there are a few prayers said in those moments?
Definitely. I know I did.
And when you survive a situation like that, do you say, okay, I've been through that, maybe we can get through anything? Or do you say, wow, that was crazy. One of these days, we're not going to make it back that way.
I never had a negative thought. I was ready to go whenever I needed to go. And I did a lot of praying.
That 33rd mission, what were you guys supposed to do that day? What went wrong, and how did you become a prisoner?
The Germans at that time were pulling back. We were out after another marshaling yard in Linz, Austria. Well, when we entered, I could tell that they were throwing everything up that they could. And there's three different kinds of flak, the regular flak, a red flak, and a white flak. Well, white flak is a phosphorus flak. When it hit the airplane sides, it just eats the skin off the airplane. We had two engines knocked out over the target and one after that. You don't fly a B-24 on one engine. So we took a quick boat. We had a boat to either parachute out right then or try to crash land. So we've all voted for crash land because we'd heard too many stories about parachuting.
What kind of stories had you heard?
The people on the ground were meeting us with pitchforks and just killing us right there on the way down. Well, we were down to about 5,000 feet, and we just couldn't hold the ground. We ended up in Gwyre, Hungary, and I can't tell you how far that is from Linz, Austria, but we crash-landed in Gwyre, Hungary. I had been hit over the eye, over my right eye and in my seat. Our tail gunner got hit in both knees, and he was unable to get out of the turret without help. So, yeah, there was a lot of panic. Our ball turret gunner, he could not bring the ball turret back up, so they had to help pull him up out of there. And needless to say, our intercom system was gone wild. We had to tell people, cool, so you can get messages from the pilot and myself. Part of my responsibilities was to detonate the radar equipment to burn it up. And the bomb site, we had to detonate it, burn it up.
You didn't want the Germans seeing what technology you had.
That's right. Also, all the radio equipment had to be detonated and burned up. So that was my job, and it kept me pretty busy until we hit. It was like a hitting up against a brick wall, and it was just a sudden stop. As soon as we did, we saw all these civilian people coming out, rushing towards us. And your first thought is, goodbye. They weren't. They were friendly. We were flying a 13-man crew, and the 11 of them went one way. That none of them were wounded. I learned later on that they had gotten back to the base within 2 days. The tail turret gunner we had to leave behind because both knees were completely shot out. So he was left with the Germans, and later on I found out that he also did a lot better than I did, that they replaced both of his knees, the Germans. Wow. Replaced both of his knees. He had steak and lamb and all that to eat. I had to go a different way. To this day, I swear I went to some kind of a church basement. And a man came in, and he took 22 stitches over my eye. He cleaned out as much of the flak out of my seat as he could. And after that, the five men from the local underground said, we need to take you on. We can't keep you here, because the Germans are on their way in. So anyhow, we walked from Gwyre, Hungary to Budapest, Hungary. At Budapest, Hungary, I gave myself up to what I thought was our allies, the Russians. As I approached, it was a big pond, and there was these soldiers all around it. And I go in with my hands up saying, Amerikansky, Amerikansky. Well, that didn't register. Underground felt like I should do away with my uniform. So they burned it and gave me civilian clothes to wear. Well, anyhow, when I got there, the only thing I could surmise is that the Russians felt like I was German because I was in civilian clothes, a blonde, blue-eyed. I had Army 45, which they took. My dog tags they took because they just said, well, that, you know, I got them from somebody else. The only thing I had that was GI was my shorts, undershorts. They stripped me down to my shorts tied my hands behind my back, and pointed to a building which was about 2 football fields away. It was a cobble field. Well, being barefooted and your hands tied in your back, you don't do too good, especially when they try to run you. I'd fall down, they'd come along, they'd kick me, and they'd hit me with the butts of their guns. By the time I got to the building, I had 4 teeth broken out, a busted nose, 3 ribs, 5 toes, and the wound over my eye opened again. I was a mess by the time I got there.
What a nightmare. And you told me you never had a negative thought the entire time. How do you not have a negative thought in that situation? That's horrible.
At that time, all you're thinking is pray. We got to the building, and they just made me take a shower. Well, I thought, gee, I've read about this shower, you know, where it's poison to come down on you. Well, it wasn't. It was a real nice, hot, cold shower. And the idea was to wash the blood off of me. Well, all they did is let the water come down. My hands were still tied, so I couldn't do anything more. After they decided I was under the shower long enough, they pulled me out, went to this building and in a room, and they had a stool or a bench. They had me get up on the bench, untied my hands from the back of me, and tied me up on a beam with my hands over my head. There was 2 women and 3 men come in, and they just started talking. I couldn't understand them, and they couldn't understand me. I kept saying, American consulate, American consulate. Anyhow, that didn't work too well. Finally, they brought in a officer, at least that's what I assumed, and he could talk broken English. And he had told me that if I didn't tell them the truth and what they wanted to know, that I would not see tomorrow. He pointed to a woman, and he said, she will get the truth out of you. Well, what they did, they put a bunch of electrodes on you. Must have been a low current, because when they activated it, my whole body, you just lose control of everything. They'd leave it on, I'd pass out, they'd wake me up, and do it, turn it on again. And I don't know how many times this occurred, but I finally decided I'm going to make up a story. And I said, there's 10,000 airplanes ready to come over to you, and you better be ready. That did not go over good. So I said, maybe I'm wrong, maybe it was 100. That went over all right. Then they were saying something else, this woman, and I couldn't understand her. And so she got real mad at me, and she had a rifle, and she came to the back of me and just really beat me up on my back. Came back in front and stuck the barrel of the gun right in my face. Well, I still couldn't understand her. All I could say is American consulate. It ended up that this man said, okay, we're going to leave you here overnight and let you think about it. And when we come back, you better be ready to tell us. Well, again, I don't know how long, but I know I was there long enough where I no longer had any feeling in my arms. It was just completely, you know, like they were dead. They had turned out the lights, so it was pure dark in there. Whenever they came back, they showered me with water, woke me up. Again, I couldn't feel anything. And I thought, well, go ahead and kill me. You know, what have I got to lose? And they decided that I was telling them everything I could. Well, when they let me down on the floor, I just collapsed. And they drugged me out of there. And I don't know how. They put me in like what I call a closet, because it wasn't long enough for me to lay down and stretch out, but I could curl up. And they kept me in there. Then they came and got me and tried to interrogate me again. Of course, I was too weak to say anything. They take me back, and all I had to in there with me was a bucket. Once a day, I had a tin can full of some kind of liquid and green stuff. Once a day. That went on for a period of time. I kept saying American consulate, American consulate. And finally, the war was over. Finally got an audience with American consulate. Well, they interviewed me, and they said, well, it's going to take about a week to 10 days to verify that what you said is true, because they check your family and all that kind of stuff. Well, they did come back, but on the interim time, the one officer said that if I said anything about how I was treated, I wouldn't see tomorrow. And he said, I'll be there when you talk to him. And you say one thing out of line, you're dead. So when they came back, they interviewed me, and they said, yeah, we're going to set you out for free. This was 30 days at least, longer than that, about 2.5 months, that all this transpired. finally, I got to, they freed me. The soldier that was there wished me luck. They had a banquet for me. They had a big roast pig on the table, full pig, and they had poured me a goblet full of what I thought was water. I didn't know any better, and man, having not had any water for so long, I bottomed up. Well, I passed out. Vodka. I truthfully don't know how long I was passed out, but when I woke up, I was back in this little closet room, and I knocked on the door until somebody came, and they finally gave me some clothes that I could put on. They were kind of big. Anyhow, we had the banquet again. I don't know if it was the same roast pig or not, but anyhow, there was another roast pig, and this time they poured me this glass, and accidentally on purpose, I hit it and it fell on the floor. Well, I never drank anymore. Because I was a guest of honor, I got the first slice off the pig. Well, it was 100 total fat. Well, I thought to myself, I can't eat that. I haven't had any food for months. So somehow that slipped off on the floor. And I got a piece of ham later. Anyhow, about a week after that banquet, the American people arranged for me to go down to the seaport in Kiev. I got on this English ship. We went from Kiev over the Black Sea back to Italy. Well, when I got back to the base was deactivated. There was a dentist apprentice and a couple of the base commander and a couple others in one tent. Well, I came down with malaria. They did the best they could for me then. And the colonel said, well, do you think you'd be ready to fly in about a week? I said, as far as I'm concerned, I'm ready to go now. After about a week, we did fly, and we went back to the States. My folks had been told early that I was missing in action. And then they came and said I was KIA. And they paid them the $10,000. And, of course, none of this I knew about. So anyhow, when I got back to the States, I called home. Well, my brother answered the phone, and he said, who is this? And I said, Jack, you dummy, I'm your brother, Dale. And he said, you're dead. We were told you were dead. Well, that hit me. He must have got hit by telling I was my. Anyhow, he told me that, well, I better call back in about an hour or so because he had to prepare the folks. My mom was not well. And I said, Jack, I can't. I don't have any money. All I got is clothes on my back, and they weren't very good. So he said, give me a number, and I'll call you back in about an hour. So that happened. And then I got to talk to my folks. All I can say is that the good Lord blessed me. And being younger than that, I guess you can survive some of those things. I didn't think I would.
But he did. And 75 years ago this week, Dale Shabilsky's parents went from believing he would be one of those remembered on Memorial Day to hearing their son's voice once again. That's all the time we have on this edition of Hometown Heroes. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that on Memorial Day and every day, freedom is not free.